Welcome back. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour, Newstime 809. This morning we have Charlie Sturgis in, our Executive Director of Mountain Trails. Good morning, Charlie. Thanks for coming.
Good morning, Carolyn.
Appreciate that. So, before we begin on all things trails, tell us about how the weekend went with the second stage of the big triple trail
challenge. Triple trail challenge. You know, around the office we call it the TTC.
Yeah, good. Okay, I like that better.
It's a lot easier to get out.
Yeah, it was a cloudy day.
It could have been just totally a heat exhaustion problem. If it had been like on Friday, it could have been crazy hot. We got super lucky. We had a great turnout. We had mist on the peak. So it was actually wasn't really raining at Shadow Lake and up, but it was misting, and actually people were describing it somewhat as cold. So and the fact that it never really seemed to get over 70 degrees during the course of the race, we had no heat issues at all, which knock on wood is, easily the case. It went really well. And, really appreciate it. I think, we do a lot to get the word out that there's going to be a race that's going to involve some of the trails. I think we try to get better at it as well so that we can touch base with as many people as possible. But we certainly saw a lack of people using the trails while the race was going on, which really appreciate that. And I think runners really appreciate it. It's safer that way. So thanks to everybody out there for actually maybe making some different plans.
Yeah, it was really well marked.
Good.
I mean, anybody who was out there like myself, just either the week before or even the day after, you could tell where you would want to have.
Yeah, day after we're a little guilty. We didn't get out there until Tuesday to get all the markings out.
The like blue markings.
So
you could see where the path went.
Exactly.
So the final event for the TTC is coming up August 18th, and that's the Mid-Mountain.
Mid-Mountain Marathon. And, this one actually, this is the first time this has happened, but we're super psyched about it because, this is not an easy race, although it was called one of the best marathons, I think, to run in Utah. But we're not full, but we're getting full. We actually think that the race might get capped and be full.
Is that a first? Ever,
that'll be a first, yeah. Normally we get 300 to 350 racers. We were already, pre-registration was already at 300. Kudos to everybody out there who's getting all excited about running a long race like that. But if you're also planning on trying to run it, it's really worth your while to register now. And also it makes it so much easier for us. And there is no day of. So unlike most other races like the Jupiter and the Ramble on, we don't have a day of for this race. We do expect you to show up registered and ready to go.
Yeah.
It's a little early start. So
how do you decide that 350 is the cap? How does that
come 400 about? Is actually
oh,
the cap.
Okay.
Actually, a lot of it is, one, what we think you can really put on the trails at any given moment. A really crowded trail marathon is just that. It's crowded. Two, it does, when you exceed 400 around here, we start to get into different types of regulations. So we start to bump into the, kind of our local government side of life. So we try to avoid that because it also tends to bring on some different levels of expenses for the race.
Okay. So, tell us about other trails.
Other trails.
Trail talk.
Let's see.
Any scheduled to open? Any?
We sort of soft opened the new one in Round Valley. I think we haven't put a tag on it for a name yet. But this is a downhill flow trail. The goal here will be it's the sequel, if you will, to the Happy Gilmore and TM area. So right at the top of the bench there, you can actually go down from there. We're not talking about it a lot at the moment because it's so dusty, and we really are dying to have some rain on it before it starts getting ridden a lot. But if you happen to be over there, it's probably worth taking a look at. It's pretty good fun. And we are working up, if you hadn't noticed, we are working up the Crescent Lift area, and we'll be doing a downflow trail there that will connect to Mid-Mountain going north out of that area. And we hope both these trails are going to be helping with some directional issues and maybe some multi-use issues. Like Rambler over in the Old Ranch area, that will become up only for bikes, And so that way, those people who really would like a little bit more peaceful and non-worrisome outing, hiking-wise, or they're hiking their dogs, you will be able to go up that trail now without expecting bikes coming down at you. So there's no reason to be going down that trail on a bike if you've got this other beautiful option right there. And we hope the same thing occurs up high on a crescent. You know, the part of the crescent mission there is potentially, and sometimes we just wait until we see how things unfold, but Tommy's might become one way up for bikes as well, which is kind of the way it was originally designed. And that's why you have some of the flatter corners on it. It wasn't designed as a, you know, bank turn, you know, kind of bank turns and grade reversals are one way to make this trail more sustainable and downhill riding.
Well, in the one way, doesn't that does sort of offer a little bit of a reprieve to hikers?
Yep. And it also eliminates washboard. Like if you look at how well Armstrong's done over the years. I mean, Armstrong's, what, 10 or 11 years old now? One way, you know, when we have one way up on for trails for bikes, particularly you get away from the stutter bumps and all that, it's pretty cool.
So what about hiking and trails and the way they're designed? I mean, Spiro seems to be deteriorating before our eyes.
Yes, ma'am.
and if you're a hiker, I can't imagine why you'd want to go up Spiro if you've got downhill people coming. Are you getting pressure? Are you getting a lot of feedback from the community about just the danger of hikers and bikers mixing?
Yeah, I think there's always concerns. I think people have some negative experiences out there. Not everyone is perfectly polite as they could be or should be. Spiro itself is problematic. It's one of the oldest trails in the area. We did a rehab on it, kind of a call it a jerry rig, really, because it really wasn't an ideal situation to be trying to refurbish that trail. We're hoping that in the next year or two we'll see a new trail that would accommodate the lift assisted rider getting all the way back to the resort, and then maybe Spiro can be repurposed for something else. In the meantime, you're right, we signed that like crazy down there. We built a trail that goes over the Dons. Other than saying this is the most dangerous place to walk uphill in the entire area, we're really trying to discourage people from going up there, whether you bike or not, or hike. But we did get a lot of feedback, Carolyn, on when we talked about making it one way. We did a survey about 2 years ago, and 50% of the respondents were not in favor of making it one way. And I wrote down it the other day as part of the sweep for the race, and I just sit there and go, this is no way I want to even hardly ride down it, much less up it.
It's just old people that responded to that, like you and me.
Yeah,
saying,
maybe.
Oh, we used to ride Spiro. It's, you know.
Yeah, but, we didn't go as fast. And We certainly, and it was kind of a test piece. There's no question that and Eagle, those kind of got your heart rate up. So, But anyways, things are good out there. Just be careful with the potential lightning out there this week, weekend. And also, I think when it is dusty and dry like this, being really cognizant of skidding and things that create stutter bumps and ruts is really important, because eventually when the rain comes back in, that loose dirt that you're stirring up with probably what we'd have to refer to as less than ideal technique basically is going to get washed off the trail, and we're going to end up with just rocks left behind.
So it's a speed thing on the downhill?
It's speed, and people, you know, there's different levels of riders, so some people grab too much brake, and it makes it skid. And speed's part of it. Skidding's part of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's leave it there. Thanks so much, Charlie.
You bet, Carolyn.
Appreciate you coming in. News time is 8:19. We have Terry Orr in the studio. She's the executive director of the Park City Performing Arts Institute. She is here to talk about the popular summer St. Regis Big Stars Bright Nights concert series. Thank you for coming, Terry.
Thanks.
So you've asked, let's get to the exciting news. You've asked Park City to change the venue permit for the remaining August and September Bright Nights events. To leave Quinn's and to bring the shows into Park City, into the city park. I guess Grace Potter must have been a real success.
It was great fun. And this really came from an outpouring of the folks that were there at the concert, who said, why can't we have all the concerts here? And we had thought all the concerts were going to be at Quinn's originally, and there was a conflict in date, which is how we ended up with one concert as a one-off at City Park. But it felt so good to be back in City Park, and it was so easy for folks. And it was, you know, it was nostalgic, and it was very quintessential Park City.
And there were comments made that it required half the security forces or, you know, police force needed as compared to the Queens Junction.
You know, the traffic is different, the all those lovely words, ingress and egress, and how the traffic flows. And there were, you know, fewer buses needed from our end. We've been supplementing the buses. So it was just easier all the way around, besides the fact it's a beautiful space.
And easier, so we had people coming from the Park City Mountain Resort parking as well as Richardson Flat?
You know, we really didn't have any takers at Richardson Flat. We did have people at the Eccles Center, and we bused them in from the Eccles Center. So if you were coming up from Salt Lake for the concert and you weren't familiar with the community, we had you park at Eccles and take the bus over because there was no parking at City Park. That was part of our agreement.
Right. What was the feedback from the neighbors and the people who use the park on a Friday night, as well as the people that live along that back area?
You know, I was at City Council last night, and they said they have received no negative feedback. We walked along the homes, the people who face the park, and spoke to them, those that were outside the day of the show and then later in the evening. And they were just happy to sit there with their friends and have a barbecue on the back porch and hear Grace Potter.
And how about the Poison Creek path area? What was that filled with people?
You know, there were some folks who rode their bikes and stopped. There were some folks beyond our fence line. But, you know, mostly everybody understood that we're a nonprofit and it matters if you buy a ticket, and they were inside the fence.
Well, if it does go to City Park, I wonder how productive it would be to have someone wandering around asking for donations who, I mean, I don't know, it was just a, you know, with a just a hat, you know, hey, would you like to? Would you like?
We certainly want to, you know, it is a park, and it is part of the city's great amenities, and we need, as a nonprofit, to have people buy tickets. At the same time, we don't want to shame anyone who's decided, you know, it's a nice night, maybe they couldn't afford the tickets, and they're sitting outside the fence line. So we hope to reach some kind of equilibrium there. And if people voluntarily want to give a free will offering, as they say in churches, we'll certainly take it.
Okay. Now, what about the turnout for the Grace Potter concert? What do you have a number count on that?
We're somewhere between 1,700 and 2,000. We give out comp tickets as well as those sold tickets. And we don't have scanners at this venue, so we're still trying to piece together the bodies and the tickets.
Okay. And how did the turf hold up with everybody out there?
You know, it did great. They're used to people being on those fields for all kinds of events. You know, they are ball fields, but they're a multi-use field as well in Park City. And I hope we're lightly there Friday night.
Okay, and you're asking the city to consider going a little later for a start time as well, if it was to happen that you'd come in.
You know, all of our concerts in the past in the summer were from 7 to 10. And it makes it easier if you're trying to come up to a concert and the gates open at 5:30 as opposed to 4:30 and you're coming from someplace else other than Park City. Or if you work, you know, a full-time job and you can't get in line at 4:30. So, yes, that would be great. We understand there are other events in the community and we don't want to step on the ingress and egress because we're trying to keep this safe. I just want to be very clear that this Monday's concert is still at Queens Junction.
Okay. And that's Chris Blue.
It is Chris Blue.
Let's segue there. Oh, my gosh. Winner of Voice's 12th season?
2017. I don't know what season it was, but last year's The Voice. Yeah.
And he's relatively new to the business of performing.
Well, to publicly performing. He's been performing since he was a small child in churches. His family sounds a bit like the Jackson family.
Yeah.
The whole family was out there performing gospel for a long time.
Yeah. And I had a chance to talk with him yesterday. The Tracks of My Tears piece, if anybody hasn't Googled that, they need to do it. Because it's stunning.
It is stunning.
It's really stunning. And anything else you want to say about his coming to Park City?
Oh, we're so excited. You know, he He had a fierce competition last year in The Voice, and he rose to the top. He was a singer, yes, but he's also going to dance a little bit on our stage and talk to us. And despite everyone's really great excitement and rumor base, Alicia Keys, his coach, is not coming here to see him. So I just want to kind of squish that so the rumor mill gets tampered down a bit. Mm-hmm. But she did spend a great deal of time and really a lot of emotional and I think some financial investment in launching him.
Yeah, listening to just some of his covers, do people still use the word swoon? Yeah,
swoon works.
Swoon. Yeah, he's really something.
Yeah, he is. And he just
kid.
Seems to be, you know, our interactions, just the nicest man. Very humble. Yeah.
Well, excellent. Anything else you want to say?
Mary Beth Maziarz will be opening for him. So she is a fabulous local singer. You know, a bit of Diana Krall. I don't know. I don't want to compare her to anyone else because she's Mary Beth. And we're delighted that she's going to open for him.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, good luck with the efforts to work on the venue, and we'll have you back again, I'm sure.
Well, thank you. And I just want to make a quick thank you to all of the city staff and the city council. This was not something they needed on their plates this summer. It's taken a lot of extra time and energy, and we're really grateful that we were able to still launch a series this summer.
And there is going to be another meeting to explore this idea, isn't it? It's next Friday.
It's a special meeting, which is another thing. Next Friday, it's cropped up. There were numerous letters to the council and people who spoke up and said, we really would like to bring this back to City Park. So this kind of launched with us and alongside of us in a groundswell from the community.
Could it potentially turn into a permanent home?
Oh, you know, I had a friend who used to say to me all the time, one disaster at a time, Terry. So I could only think about getting through this summer, but that's a lovely thought.
Okay. Thanks much for coming in.
Thank you.
My next guest here in the studio is Lynn Ware-Peek. She is one of the city council members, and she's here to talk about the meeting last night. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Good morning, Carolyn.
All right. Let's start with Luke Cardin's presentation. It's a program. He's the environmental sustainability manager for the city, and he presented a program that would put carbon back into the ground and positively impact the environment, the water, the soil, even the air. Let's talk about what that is.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. And as he said, he gave us Agroecology 101 course last night. And I actually walked the McPolin farm with him a few months ago to look at it. So currently what happens is when there's no disturbance to the land, i.e. disturbance caused from grazing, what happens is the grass grows. It grows too long, it falls over and dies, and it doesn't get sort of trampled back and recycled and composted back into the soil. And therefore it sort of doesn't reseed and regrow, and then it allows for invasive species to come in and just not healthy vegetation and not healthy soil. So this is essentially a way of, it's called carbon farming, which sequesters carbon by increasing the soil health by regenerating the vegetation, the healthy vegetation that's there. And the way that's done now, you know, in the past, we've always thought of, you know, we've heard of overgrazing, and that's what ruins the soil. Well, this is a very calculated way of grazing. It's not leaving cattle on the land forever. It's getting them switching, almost like a crop rotation idea. And so that's what he's looking at, and you see it happening. We walked up to the Frank Richards parcel, which is just uphill and south of the area, and Bill White Farms has been working there with the same sort of concept, and it's really interesting. The vegetation is so much thicker there, and essentially that's what happens when you get that, you know, continual disturbance and grazing, you know, if it's done in the right way.
Now, I feel like I've seen cows out there in recent years. Is that
so? The Ivers parcel or the Ivers, there are some cows grazing on the very north end by the church. So that's happened. And if you look at the vegetation there, it is in the soil much healthier. So really interesting. And the thing that we like about this, or that I like, is that there's potential for education. So making it this sort of, living, working farm concept, where you're educating groups of people, school children, about carbon sequestration and how doing what we would be doing out there would be furthering the community goal of, being net zero.
And is there some discussion about actually growing crops out there, or is it just we're looking at grazing at this point?
Yeah, not to my understanding, it's not really about growing crops. It's more about creating healthy soil that becomes the carbon sink.
Okay. Let's talk about Nate Rockwood. He's the budget manager, and he came back to council to talk about the Armstrong 2 property, also known as the Snow Creek Ranches, looking at considering including some money towards that, towards helping preserve that as open space, and maybe joining that with the Treasure Mountain bond initiative that will be on the ballot this November. Can you talk a little bit about, let's talk about the property. What would be allowed in terms of access, if any?
On the Armstrong 2
property?
On the
Armstrong 2.
Well, as far as we know, and we don't know a lot about it, that deal is just kind of coming to fruition after Utah Open Lands has literally been working on it for about a decade. But what we understand is that there would be some sort of trail access that would hook into the current Armstrong Trail, which was, that was Armstrong 1. But otherwise, there would be the same agricultural use that's going on now that the Armstrong family has going on there, the grazing, and that's about it in those 19 acres that we're talking about.
Okay, and it's not a substantial amount of money that the city's looking at. I mean, compared to what we're looking at for the Treasure Mountain purchase, but $3 million is what I understand it to be?
What the city has said is up to $3 million it would be willing to do to help in the fundraising effort for the deal that Utah Open Lands has going.
Okay, and is there some number that would be an average tax burden for a property owner?
Well, what we're looking at now and what Nate presented, and by the way, this kind of came about because Mayor Andy talks to a lot of community groups, and he found in the recent weeks that people had come up with the idea of combining the two properties that have been really, you're familiar with COSAC, and these were identified as like those last two jewels, Treasure and Armstrong 2, or the Snow Ranch pastures, as really the last big, the last, legacy bits of open space that we want to preserve. And so I think because there was concern out there by those who really wanted to see the Armstrong property preserved, that somehow, maybe presenting the treasure as, in and of itself with the bond, it would maybe compromise that. So they asked Andy to consider the possibility of, just exploring what would it look like if you combine these two on the same bond. So essentially, it's not going to cost the taxpayer any more. It's sort of broadening the appeal overall for the bond is kind of how it's been presented. So we're still looking at that 50.7. Actually, now it's 50.6 for both.
Okay, and it did seem like there was a fair amount of public support. Bob Richer, KPCW's chairman of the board, Cindy Matsumoto, prior council member, gave input. There were others there. Did any of their comments in support of this project, did they influence you? Have you changed your opinion about it? Are you ready to say where you stand on it?
So I think that council overall wanted to sort of reserve comment until we really hear from a lot of the community. So yes, we had those people that came out in force last night. Well, I shouldn't say in force. There were probably, I think, 5 or 6 people that gave public comment, all very much in support. And, you know, when that happens, if there are people in the room who are opposed, you know, maybe they decide not to get up and talk. And, you know, I just want to say to our community in general that, you know, if you're listening to this now and you have an opinion or a strong feeling either way, even if your thoughts aren't fully formed or you feel like you can't articulate them in the way you want, you know, you don't have to stand up at public comment during a city council meeting. I get that. It's kind of intimidating. But please send us an email. It's council_mail@parkcity.org. And we really, really want to hear from the community on this one, because again, the idea behind combining these two properties into one bond is kind of, again, sort of sweetening the deal, sweetening the pot, broadening the appeal for the whole thing to you know, eventually pass.
Okay, let's talk about social equity. Kilo Zamora, social equity expert and aficionado, lecturer at the University of Utah, has provided services to the Park City Leadership Organization now for many years, and he's coming back August 2nd. And it seems like council is really trying to, again, solicit input from the community about just what they hope to see out of a social equity program. And I wonder if it's a similar thing, that people are afraid to stand up and say, I don't think that this is a good program, because, and then for fear of sounding like they are bigoted or whatever, mm-hmm. when in fact there are many perspectives on this issue. What is Kilo going to do for council on August 2nd? What happens now?
Well, what Kilo has been doing, and I assume it's just it'll be a continuation of what he has been doing, is that he's really forcing us to have the conversation about what we think that social equity is and what our feelings are around it. And it's funny because I attended the Temple Har Shalom Shabbat service where they're doing the same thing. I mean, social equity is it is a big conversation now. I think, you know, I don't know, defining the term maybe in the religious community, as well as in a lot of municipalities, saying that we need to sort of define it in the way that works for our community and our community needs, and we want to sort of formalize what we do with it. And so at the Shabbat service, you know, they also said, we need to sit with this and we need to just talk about what it means to us and what we think it means in our community. And when you just start talking, the stories start coming out. You know, just an example, one gentleman had started talking about, he got involved with this program back in some other city called Sober Living. And he said, I never thought that I would have this sort of compassion and empathy that would come out for people who were struggling with staying sober. But I volunteered at this place, and I found that for some reason, it really spoke to me. And, you know, I think that we've got a really good living, breathing example of social equity going on right now in the community. And I think it was forwarded because of our talk about social equity at the city. And that is the Lucky Ones coffee shop. If you go in there and you order coffee and you talk to some of the kids that are working in there, I call them kids, but they're mostly kids. And you see that coffee shop is empowering them to have a job and to have a lot of meaning and to interact with the community. Not only is it helping them, but it's really helping our community have, you know, empathy, create more compassion, and understand. It's an education for us as well. And, you know, the National Ability Center's been practicing social equity now for, what, 30 years?
Yeah, exactly. Well, so have you received feedback from any of the community? I mean, I know I've heard Tim Henney speak about, come on, people, what are your thoughts? We're not hearing both sides of this issue.
Well, again, you know, it tends to happen that the people who show up to city council meetings and study sessions are those that are in great support of what you're doing. And it's wonderful because they get up and they talk, and they talk about what it means to them, and it helps sort of shape council's view of it, right? But we are, you know, I think what we're hearing more than anything is, you know, really, what is it? I don't get this. And is this really the city's role? Isn't this the nonprofit role? And what we say as a city is, I think that we can take the position of being real leaders, and we can coalesce all of the various efforts made by all the nonprofit community. And, you know, there are other groups that do that too, like the Community Foundation. But we think that and it's going this way in our nation, is that it becomes the role of the city, really, to bring all of these voices together and all these efforts together.
And it sounds like cities are moving, some cities, towns across the country are moving in those directions, just as you pointed out with the sober city.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Example. Well, that's a good transition into the letter that was written this week by Mayor Andy Bierman to our congressional delegation, Congressman Bishop, Senator Hatch, Senator Lee, addressing immigration. And that letter, I believe, can be found on the I know it's on KPCW's website, but I'm sure it's also on the Park City .org website. It asks our representatives to treat immigrants with humane and compassionate practices and to come up with a path to citizenship for the nearly 1 million dreamers that live in this country and work and participate in our communities. So what happens now? I mean, this letter has been sent to our representatives. Now what happens with our news cycle being so short-sighted and just constant barrage of changing and outrageous things happening? How do we stay on task with this, and what do we do next?
Well, you know, I think it sort of started with, last fall, you know, the city council passed a resolution in support of the DACA kids in our community and overall across the nation. And over the winter, we had meetings with the offices of Senator Hatch, Senator Lee, and Representative Bishop. And, you know, they were very well received. I think it was really great to be able to invite some DACA students from our community into these meetings and say, you know, look, this is Enrique, who works for the city at the MARC and for the police department. And he's made great contributions to our community. And here he is. He's a DACA kid, and we want to support him. And so I think what it does when a municipality sort of speaks out in support of these or denouncing, you know, for example, the practices going on at the border with families being separated. And now really the problem there is the concern about them being reunited. It just brings it down to a local level. And what we're doing is we're saying we value this community of people without whom this city would stop functioning. And so we really advocate for their humane treatment. And we want an answer for these hundreds of kids in the in our town that are DACA kids. And so, I mean, I think that's what it does. And every little bit, we found that when we met with those offices of our elected state officials, that they really welcomed it. And again, it just brought more of a, I don't know, like a human aspect to it. It enabled them to touch and talk to people who this is directly affecting.
And has anyone received direct feedback from our delegation, our Congressman Bishop, or was it just his office representatives?
You know, we work a lot with Jim Barker, who's our friend in Washington, who helps us who helps advocate for things that are of interest in our community. And, you know, he's felt very good about sort of the communication between our congressional delegation and the city.
Okay, great. Okay, let's see what else. The Park City Institute, we just visited with Terry Orr. They want to make a change of venue going forward from August into September. Where Where is your opinion on this? It sounded like you thought there might be some really fantastic nostalgia involved, which
yes.
I get that too.
Well, you know, more and more in this community, we're talking about the importance of locals and that feeling of being local. And we've heard locals saying, you know, the locals need to be thrown a bone. And, you know, with more pressures on this community with events and just everything going on, anything that can help us grasp that, okay, nostalgia of being a local, you know, we just kind of love. And it just kind of came back to council in with comments from the public and just what I heard around town after the Grace Potter concert. I was out of town that evening, so I didn't experience it. But what I heard, it just, when people talked about it, there was this twinkle in their eye. And you know, it was just kind of interesting. And so I felt like we really needed to entertain that. And as I didn't hear all of Terry's interview, but I think that there's there are things that make it easier, but there also, to a population of people that live in that area, there are greater impacts. And so what we want to do, and council is going to go out with staff, and we're going to go knocking on doors between now and this special meeting we called a week from today. And we're going to say, hey, what would you think about 6 more concerts happening? And, you know, it's going to be difficult, but I feel like if the residents are on board, we probably will be. Ultimately, you know, Jenny Dearson is the one who really has worked so closely with this and along with Jonathan Weidenhammer, and their recommendation counts for a lot as well.
Okay, great. And just quickly, the Kimball Arts Festival, the report given to the council was very detailed. It was approved. Mm-hmm. Everything's set to go for the Kimball Arts Festival this year.
Yes, it is. And they did a great job, really thorough job of presenting their supplemental package.
Okay, there was some talk about a patio.
Oh, yes. And this had to do with, we sort of sorted it out within the meeting, but there's that, the vibrancy ordinance, which is where, you know, when businesses have a dark storefront for all of the year, except for, say, Sundance, and they make their money in that one week. So this, you know, and we passed an ordinance preventing that from happening. And so our question just was, because they're going to be using this patio where the old, I call it the Bonhoff Sports Building, but mm-hmm. where the church public house was, is that, you know, are they sort of in violation of that? But actually, they're not. And Kimball Arts Fest is able to use that at no cost anyway. So it's not like that building owner is really benefiting.
Sure. Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming in, Lynn Ware-Peak from Park City Council. Good morning. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. My final guest is Carolyn Rose. She is the Summit County Nursing Director, and she is in to talk about the West Nile virus, which has appeared in 3 counties in northern Utah, Uinta, Box Elder, and Davis, and also to talk about inoculations for our children. They don't call them that anymore, do they?
No, it's
inoculations.
Immunizations. So awful.
I know, inoculations. Where did I come up with that one? Anyway, welcome. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate you making the effort here. So West Nile virus was first recognized, from what I have read, in the Western Hemisphere in 1999, and it was found in sick birds, flamingos and pheasants that were at the Bronx Zoo. And also from dead crows, apparently, in New York City, which is kind of interesting. So no cases in humans have been found at this point.
Not this year.
This year. There have been in the past.
Yes, there have been.
So let's talk about the virus a little bit and what people should know about it.
Okay. So the virus is obtained or affects humans by mosquito bite. It also affects horses, the raptor-type birds. Rarely will you see it in the other animals. However, humans and horses are where it affects them the most.
Yeah, there have been some concerns coming from the equine community.
Right, and there is a vaccine, actually, for horses that I know that some of my friends who have horses have inoculated their animals with that.
Okay, let's use that today. Okay. Let's use that word. So what about, there are people who can get the virus but never show symptoms.
That's correct.
And is it the kind of thing that it can lay dormant for periods of years like other viruses do?
No, or? Not typically. It's just one of those things that most people who are healthy, and I'll say most, I'll not say all, that get bitten by a mosquito that contains or carries West Nile virus, they may have no symptoms at all. Other people will get a fever, and some of those people get a high enough fever that it requires hospitalization. Some people who really cannot fight it off get the neuroinvasive disease, and that's the one that hospitalizes people and can actually kill them.
Well, there was a high school football coach last year that died, and it was in 2017. He died from meningitis, which was believed to have been caused by the West Nile virus. But that is a pretty extraordinary example, I presume.
Yes, it does happen. But yes.
So, 20% of the people who are infected by the virus, it appears, show symptoms. From the things that I've read.
That could be true.
Could be true.
I'm sorry,
this
I'm
is
not,
a test.
We I haven't. it was 2007 when we first got our big surge of education for West Nile virus because it took a while to come across the country. Last year, in 2017, we saw more human cases than we had for years since about 2007. So I don't know what prompted that. I'm not sure. I mean, you could probably dig down deep into, you know, how wet it is, how well the mosquitoes are adapting or living in their environment. I mean, there's all sorts of factors that can you know, make that number of people who have the illness increase.
What are the symptoms people should be concerned with?
Kind of cold-like symptoms, just like so many diseases, you know, think you have this little common cold and bam. But, you know, if you've been in an area where there are active mosquitoes, and there's only two types of mosquitoes that carry the West Nile virus. So in Summit County, we do have one of the types of mosquitoes. However, I have not heard anything from our mosquito abatement district that we've had any positive pools. So mosquito abatement plays a big part in the surveillance of West Nile, and they routinely test standing waters, certain pools, like on wetlands or ponds or, you know, creek sides and those types of things. And they monitor those starting in the spring throughout the fall.
Okay.
So that helps people to know. And you can go on the Utah Department of Health website and find out where those positive pools are. And that's where, as you just mentioned, there are three different counties in Utah that have come up with positive pools. We've had no cases of human West Nile, and there's been two birds, a raven and a red-tailed hawk, that have been tested and have been positive, and they were in the areas where there was also the positive pools.
Oh, okay. Now, basic things people should do, standing water, be aware.
Correct.
Getting rid of that. Wear DEET in the evenings and early morning hours if you're outside.
Correct. Or long sleeves. Some people don't like to use, you know, that kind of a spray, but that is the one that protects you the best. But you can also do long sleeves. They have so many different clothing types now that are cool, but they're long sleeve, long pants. Just, you know, protect yourself. Be aware of where you're at. Most of our mosquitoes up here are nuisance mosquitoes, which, you know, you just want to swat them and they're like, oh, I can't stand this, you know. But the DEET is the best protection if you're going to use any kind of a bug spray, especially like if you're going in the Uintas this weekend, up by Strawberry, you know, any of those places. Even though we haven't detected West Nile there, nobody really likes mosquito bites. They're uncomfortable.
Right. So. Anything else about West Nile before we move on to immunizations?
No, just but if you're traveling south, you need to be concerned. If you're traveling to places like Florida, Mexico, those types of things, West Nile is active there, as is the Zika virus, and both of them are obtained from mosquito bites.
Mm-hmm. So. Best not to be bitten if you can help it.
Yes.
Okay. So let's school
yes.
can't be around
just
the corner, but it is.
Just want to remind parents that school is right around the corner. I was in Walmart the other day, and I said, "Oh my gosh, they have school supplies already." Really, it's not the kids don't want to even think about it. I don't want to think about it. So, but it'll come quickly. And if your child is entering kindergarten or seventh grade, you need to be aware that there are rules in Utah that require immunizations. You can call your local doctor. You can come to the local health department. All of our offices have specific days, and you can call for an appointment to come in. We do accept quite a few insurances. So just, you know, take a look at your child's record, especially kindergarten and seventh grade. If your child's going to college, it's probably a little late, but some of the colleges out of state do require certain vaccines, and you need to check into that.
Right. And what would be those contact phone numbers do you have?
Actually, it's probably easiest to go to our website, which is summitcountyhealth.org.
Okay.
And the main Park City number is 333-1500. Colville is 336-3234. And Camas is 783-3161.
Okay.
So we have offices for everyone.
Okay. Thank you for coming in, Carolyn Rose.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Appreciate that update.